until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remaining but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rada El-Attash, who is a translator and op-ed columnist for the Gulf News in the United Arab Emirates. She's the daughter of the former Syrian ambassador, Jaber El-Attash, and she emigrated to the United States from Syria in 1986. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rada El-Attash.
Thank you.
And obviously, you were quoted in an article in Al Jazeera that I noticed, Rada, about this sort of paradox that the Syrian agony is producing great poetry. Of course, that is not something that one would you wouldn't wish the agony in order to create poetry and art. But I take it under the Assads, with the censorship and oppression of that regime, there wasn't a lot of freedom of expression. Is that why things are flourishing in spite of the hideous nature of this civil war?
Yes, for sure. This revolution has given birth to a new Syrian voice, a voice that is not afraid to say and to write and to express something that Syrians were not able to do previous to the revolution.
And a number of poets and writers, of course, have already paid the price, have they not? The poet Ibrahim Katush was kidnapped and killed in July of 2011. Dia al-Abdallah and Tal al-Marushi, excuse my pronunciation here, they're still in prison. And Khalid Khalifa was attacked in Damascus and had his left hand broken. So I imagine that, well, the jails are always full of poets. Poets and thinkers are the first people that dictators go after. I mean, unfortunately, that's the way of the world.
It is. It is unfortunate. But again, the wall of fear has been broken and people are still writing and they are expressing. Social media has been very, very active, and people are writing from all corners within Syria and outside of Syria, expressing their opinions of the regime and of everything that's happening. You know, Syria today is not really what Syrians wanted either. They did this revolution began with the idea of freedom. That's how it started. But we're still awaiting the spring to come. What's happening now and how the events turned out is not what any Syrian wishes. And they are also very, very frustrated with what's happening, very, very disappointed in the reaction of the world. They've lost faith in the international community. Syria is always been known to be a secular country. We're not about the jihadists. We're not about the extremists. So I am by no means a supporter of the regime, but what's happening is also not what a Syrian wants.
So some of the poems that were mentioned in Al Jazeera, one by Najat Abdul Samad called "When I Am Overcome by Weakness," just quoting, "I bandage my heart with the determination of that boy. They hit him with an electric stick on his only kidney until he urinated blood, yet he returned and walked in the next demonstration. I bandaged it with the outcry, death and not humiliation." And Arada, I heard that yesterday from a U.S. reporter who was in the Syrian refugee camps in Jordan, that there was a sense that the people were just free of the humiliation and that they were prepared to face death. Some of the people he quoted said they wanted the U.S. to bomb even their own homes, and because they wanted so desperately to get rid of Assad. So then, of course, there are those people that either support the regime or support the status quo or are afraid of the jihadis. So give me your understanding of where things stand in terms of the rival sentiments in this torn country on the eve of what could be an American strike.
So, you know, my position, I'm not a political analyst. I want to deliver the human suffering. I want to deliver the voice of my people. I will do so just now by actually quoting, I've translated three different answers to people who are currently in Syria who have taken different stands on this dilemma. But I believe that you will also find that they all are in agreement when it comes to military intervention. And before I quote these three people, I would like to express that, again, although I'm not a politician here, I do not believe that missiles and more weapons will solve the problem. I am by no means with the regime, but we do not need more weapons. We need an intervention, but not in this way. See, the problem is the questions to be asked, has the United States really used all of its power to find solutions, to pressure other countries to come together and to stop supporting the jihadists and extremists? I believe that this war has been extremely unethical. Most groups, most of the international community is either aligned with one side or another. But there has not really been much done to pressure the international community to come together. 150,000 have been killed. 1 million children are displaced. That means, you know, that a whole generation now of children is lost. Very little are receiving schoolings. But I do believe that a military intervention would further destabilize Syria. America's record has been, unfortunately, to destroy. So I don't trust that. We need to stop the bloodshed. We need the solution that keeps the country running, that keeps kids in school, that it is about changing the regime, but not destroying the structure of the country as was in the case of Iraq. And I will tell you what my friends have said when I asked them this question. The question was as simple as that. Do you believe that a military intervention should take place in Syria? So I'll read you. The first one was written by Asim, and Asim wrote, "I don't personally trust the American government and its intentions. I firmly believe that an American intervention will hurt the Syrian people instead of hurting the regime. For if the American government really and truly intended to help the Syrians, it would have found ways to pressure the regime and to remove it within days without a drop of blood. But American decisions are dependent on the interests of other countries. Americans are not about protecting the freedom of the Syrian people, which was the basis of a revolution. That is the least of their concern." Anas writes, "Syrians are divided. Some are scared to death from destruction, and others see it as hope for a solution for the ongoing destruction. There is complete polarity in Syrian opinions. But most of us know that the intervention is not aimed for the people's interest, but to protect the political interest of the neighboring countries. And even the most hopeful know that the U.S. intervention is not going to rid us of the problem. And we also know that 150,000 people dead and 200,000 detained did not move anyone to action. So why now 1,400 martyrs killed by chemical weapons have moved others to actions? We have lost trust in the international community." And just one last one. Suhad writes, "No one wants for Syria to be hit. We all know this will mean more destruction, but we can't take this anymore. We wish that the hit will target one person only, Assad and his close circle. But we know better, for when war starts, it is blind and it does not spare anyone. We are so scared for our children who are fighting." And so as I said, I think there is a consensus here that all have lost faith, all are scared, they have lost trust, they don't believe in the intentions of the U.S. and the community.
These came from Facebook today, right, just a few hours ago.
Yes, just
so
a few hours.
These are very much up to date. Now, the last person you quoted mentioned going after the regime itself as opposed to bombing the Syrian people who are already being bombed in any case. You know, that unfortunately has been the pattern of U.S. intervention since the end of the Cold War, starting in Panama. We went to war twice against Saddam Hussein and destroyed his country, but not eventually, of course, they hanged him. But the long and the short of it is that there seems to be a dysfunction here, that getting rid of dictators creates enormous collateral damage. In your mind, I mean, let's begin with what you mentioned, your objections and fear of the jihadist opposition or the members of the opposition that are jihadis that have largely been brought in by Saudi and Qatari money. What about this dictator, though? The reason this country's in its agony is because of this dictatorship that's been around for over 40 years. And as far as I can tell, they consider this their private plantation, this family. And they believe in their divine right to rule. And essentially what Assad says to the world is, it's either me or the terrorists. And he's prepared to destroy the country in order to maintain his personal privilege. I find that deeply distasteful.
Yes, it is. It is deeply disturbing, and it's deeply unethical. And no one should have to go. No one should have to undergo the oppression that the Syrians have lived for that long. I know friends of mine, personal friends of mine, who have been in Syrian political prisons. They tell you stories that send chills down your spine. And they have escaped the country. They've left their families. They meet their families in Jordan and Lebanon because they could still not enter the country. So for sure, I am not a supporter of the regime by any means. But what is happening today, the interest of, like you said, Qatar and Saudi, the support of the jihadists and extremists is not for the Syrian people. It is not helping the Syrian people. It is causing so much more suffering and so much more destruction. This is not the solution. And the solution should be forcing, pressuring all these international players to come together and really look out to decrease the suffering of the people. But this is not the case. And I don't know what the solution is. Unfortunately, it's become much more complicated. There was a six-month opportunity at the beginning. So much could have been done. A no-fly zone should have been put into place. More humanitarian aid could have been sent. Weapons for Free Syrian Army should have been sent. Yes, that would have solved a lot of problems, but now it has gone into a very, very dark pit, unfortunately.
So do you think then that there's a way out via this Russian offer? I know you're not a political scientist, you're a poet, but give me your analysis of whether you think this is a way out. It's not necessarily going to get rid of the regime, but it's going to get rid of the regime's chemical weapons. At least that's what the Syrian foreign minister has agreed to.
See, but the ironic thing here is that it's now about chemical weapons. The regime has weapons that have been able to destroy buildings, in moments with families and with children and with women and with men instantly. So this whole talk about chemical weapons, it's almost cynical. You know, why is it now chemical weapons? What about the hundreds of thousands that have died? What about the other weapons as fatal as mass destruction weapons that have been used? It just doesn't make sense, not to me at least.
And tell us about the sectarianism, which most analysts see this as a Sunni versus Alawite battle in terms of a larger proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and then in the context of a global competition between the United States and Russia. One of the poems that was mentioned in the Al Jazeera article by Yusuf Bou Yeher, titled "I Am a Syrian," declares, "My scent is the scent of my homeland, the soil after the rain, and my Syria is my only religion." Give us a sense of that nationalism that transcends sectarianism.
I wish that you could have visited. Have you ever gone to Syria yourself?
No, not recently, no.
Yes. Well, you know, the most beautiful part about my country is that it was a very secular country. Our best friends were of all kinds of sects and all kinds of religions. And, I always use this example. We live in buildings and, you know, narrow streets. Damascus, it's known for its beautiful old neighborhoods and narrow streets. And so imagine this. And this is not just a story. It really does happen. On the balcony, for example, a balcony facing another balcony, a woman who is a Muslim will ululate for the wedding of her friend who is a Christian across the balcony for her, and she will celebrate. That is what Syrians are about. Religion never divided us. I would love to be able to read this poem in whole. It's not long. It's for Yusuf Buyahya from Sweda, and it really does say a lot. I think it will give you an answer to your question. May I do so?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the poet is Yusuf Buyahya from Sweda, Syria, and he writes, I am a Syrian, exiled in and out of my homeland, and on knife blades with swollen feet I walk. I am a Syrian, Shiite, Druze, Kurd, Christian, and I am Alawite, Sunni, and Circassian. Syria is my land. Syria is my identity. My sect is the scent of my homeland, the soil after the rain, and my Syria is my only religion. I am a son of this land, like the olives, apples, pomegranates, chicory, cacti, mint, grapes, figs. So what use are your thrones, your Arabism, your poems, and your elegies? Will your words bring back my home and those who were killed accidentally? Will they erase tears shed on this soil? I am a son of this green paradise, my hometown, but today I am dying from hunger and thirst. Barren tents in Lebanon and Amman are now my refuge, but no land except my homeland will nourish me with its grains, nor will all the clouds in this universe quench my thirst. And Ian, I translated this poem because it represents me as a Syrian. It represents Syrians. We are not people about sects. We are not divided in the way that it is today. We were all one before this started.
Well, that's a very moving poem. And do you have another one we could close out with?
Yes, sure. This other one, actually, it's from a friend. Her name is Lama. Lama was in Homs, and it wasn't really, it's not a poem. It's a few lines that she wrote to me that touched me and also represented a voice from Syria that I would like to deliver to the West. And this is a mother of two, and she writes, I want to once again hear the voices of the merchants strolling the streets, selling their vegetables and calling out tomatoes, eggplants, cucumbers. I want to live so that I can once again curse the cold winds and hums as it blows through my hair as I walk the streets of my hometown. I want to hear the people haggling over prices. I want for my daughter to live in Homs, to ride her bicycles with her Syrian friends, regardless of their sect and without fear. I want my daughter to love my hometown and to forget about a war that has stormed into her life. I do not want her to harbor a vengeful heart. And one final one I must read to you. It's just two lines. It was written by Najat Abdus-Samad, a Syrian novelist and a friend of mine. And she said, she calls Syria her mother, and she writes, my mother, my Syria, has blessed me with 23 million brothers and sisters, whose every drop of blood is my drop of blood, and whose hunger is my hunger, and whose pain is my pain. These lines represent what Syrians are about.
Well, Arada, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Arada El-Atrash, who joined us from Calgary in Canada, where she's a translator and op-ed columnist for the Gulf News in the United Arab Emirates. She's the daughter of the former Syrian ambassador, Jabba El-Atrash, and she emigrated to the United States from Syria in 1986. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a presidential speechwriter about Obama's heavy lift.
وطني